Good afternoon. We'll call the House Education Finance Committee to order, and appreciate everyone being here. I'm thrilled today. Actually, we've got a wonderful presentation that I've been looking forward to from the Minnesota School Boards Association and Minnesota High Tech Association and others. So with that, if the first presenters want to come on up to the testifier table, I think, did we get our technology all figured out for the presentation and we're good? Okay. And while that's happening, let's see, Representative Christensen, if you want to move the minutes from the March 10th meeting.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
All right. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Christensen. And Representative Christensen, did you want to go to the presenters table and introduce some of our speakers?
Madam Chair, members, today we're going to have a great presentation on technology in the classroom from MSBA. I'd like to hand it over to Denise Dietrich and MSBA and a whole slew of testifiers to present this to us.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Denise Dietrich, and I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And the school board members across the state would like to thank Representative Christensen for authoring bills to help highlight the need for technology in the state of Minnesota. We would also like to thank Chair Loon for allowing us this time here on the agenda today to also highlight the need for to highlight what schools are doing in terms of technology in our schools and the need for technology and where we might be going in the future. Before I get going, what I would like to do is just give you a little bit of context for how this group of people came together, who we are, and what we're going to talk about a little bit today. So about 6 months ago, the Minnesota School Boards Association began working with the Minnesota High Tech Association and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And we wanted to start the discussion of where are we at in terms of technology in our schools. So we started out with three questions: where are we, where do we need to go, and how do we get there? As we began the discussion, we shared experiences and goals, and actually a theme evolved that encompassed a response to all three of these questions. The theme that we landed on is technology is the conduit to opportunity. And I thought that was really pretty clever for a bunch of IT people to come up with this theme. And I do have to admit, though, maybe we need to define conduit before we get going on this presentation. So I do need to admit, the first thing that I did is I grabbed my red Webster's dictionary off my bookshelf that I actually got for high school graduation. That dates me. And looked up the word conduit, and then I thought, now come on, I am working with very experienced IT people, I'm going to go to dictionary.com. So what you see on the screen is dictionary.com definition of conduit. Conduit, a natural or artificial channel by which something is conveyed. The synonyms, channel, pipe, or tube. Conduit actually became the perfect word as we talked, because it became really clear that technology is the means and not the end. Technology has become and will be in the future a required conduit in our schools by which our students engage in everyday life, learning basic skills as well as 21st century skills, and as they prepare for their own personal career paths. Today, with the expertise of the people in this room, we want to demonstrate some of the ways that technology is being used or as the conduit to effective learning today in our classrooms. But it is really important to note that not all of these experiences are available to all students in the state. These opportunities are not as uniform as our Minnesota Constitution envisions. There is a digital gap in our state, and many times that is affected by zip code. But however, these experiences can provide the roadmap of where we should be going and where we want to go in education as far as technology goes. Although we do share one belief, and one component to this whole discussion is how do we get there, is how do we make sure that all school districts have the resources they need to make sure that all students have the opportunity to positively participate in the digital world that has swept every aspect of a child's world these days. Without equity in technology innovation in our schools, we are marginalizing some students who will not be as prepared to enter the 21st century workforce. So with that, normally at this time we have Gary Amoroso from the Minnesota Association of School Administrators with me, and he introduces the group of people that we're working with. But he asked me to send his regrets. He is at his spring conference, and so he needs to be there with all of his peeps. But in his absence, I am going to go ahead and introduce our first speaker, and then each person will thereafter go ahead and introduce themselves just to save on time. So our first speaker who is going to kick off this presentation is Josh Swanson, Assistant Superintendent of the Eden Prairie Schools.
Thank you, Chair Loon and committee members, for the opportunity to be here today. As Denise stated, my name is Josh Swanson, the Assistant Superintendent for Eden Prairie Schools. I just left Gary and his peeps at the board meeting to come here and head back after that, as I serve on the board for the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, representing the educational technology leaders. I'd like to start today by taking you back a moment. An interesting thing happened around 1993. The National Center for Supercomputing Applications created a product called Mosaic. It was capable of taking data that had been moving across a mostly unused internet and displaying it in a way that was better than just words. It had graphics and eventually the ability to integrate sound and video. It was the birth of what we would call the internet. Then the whole world changed as we know it. Well, most of it anyway. Since the advent of what we view as the modern internet, nearly every segment of industry has had to reinvent themselves. The internet has been one of the most significant drivers of our economy and has become deeply embedded in our personal lives. It has changed how we connect and work with others. Schools, for the most part, have adapted slowly to change. Books have been written about why this is, but a large part of the issue is one of adequate resources. While many of us remember a world without internet, the students we see today do not know a world without it. In fact, we're very quickly approaching a timeline where our parents with school-aged children have never known what it was like to look in a phone book, consult an encyclopedia, or call a library to ask for specific information. In an ideal world, schools would be trying to prepare students for a trajectory that propels them into post-secondary life, prepared to not just survive in that new world, but to thrive in it. We want to continue to push our students to lead change, innovation, and leadership. And in an ideal system, we would be ahead of where the world is going. In most Minnesota school districts, we are behind and running at a constant pace, while the world is running faster with each lap. We would like to spend our time with you today describing the state of Minnesota schools and technology, and to hopefully help you understand why we both have passion and a sense of urgency for this conversation. We will describe why Minnesota's workforce will need fluidity in the use of technology to not only work with information, but to engage others in problem solving and to innovate. We see technology as a conduit to opportunity, a means of giving all Minnesota students a better chance of success in college, career, and in life. Our vision is for every student in Minnesota to be a digital learner. To date, Minnesota's funding model has treated technology as an option. It is not. This creates an opportunity gap for our students, and as long as that exists, we will not be able to truly become an example of educational excellence. We believe that technology is the conduit to opportunity, that technology creates authentic and meaningful learning opportunities, that technology helps us build a highly effective and competent workforce. We believe that through building the conduit to opportunities, we will eliminate disparities and opportunity gaps that exist because of zip code, and that technology is critical to ensure each of our children develops the 21st century skills and global competencies to be successful as they leave our public education system. We believe that as a state, we have the opportunity to be a model of educational excellence for others across the country, and that we can transform education for each child in the classroom. We believe that how we go about doing this is through ensuring that our children in schools have connectivity and access, that our schools embrace digital learning, that we leverage data systems, and that appropriate resources are available for professional development and support. Today, members of our team will describe how, as a state, we could go about creating a technology conduit and what that would look like. We believe that we need to invest in educational excellence and invest in technology to strategically position our state and our children for the future. Today, we will be speaking about each of the four areas I have outlined and that are currently on the screen. I would like to begin by introducing Margaret Anderson Kelleher, who is the president and CEO of Minnesota High Tech Association and the chair of the Governor's Broadband Task Force, to speak about connectivity, which is a foundational first step.
Welcome, Speaker Kelleher. It's great to have you with us in the committee, and I know you have been working on this in many capacities in your life post-legislature, so we appreciate you being here today.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. We're grateful that you would focus some of your hearing time on this issue, and today I'm before you in both my capacity as the chair of the Governor's Broadband Task Force, and first I'm going to speak to you a little bit in that capacity and talk a little bit about connectivity across the state and what it means. And then I'm going to put on my hat as the president and CEO of the Minnesota High Tech Association and talk a little bit about what it means to industry in terms of readiness for employment and what job outlooks look like into the future. So I will try to make that clear distinction for you. First of all, the Governor's Broadband Task Force. This is at least the third Governor's Broadband Task Force. Governor Pawlenty had at least two broadband task forces. There were others before that that were focused on broadband. And our task force is actually in the process of reappointment right now under Governor Dayton. And this is a task force that is responsible for developing policies and recommendations to the governor. I think that you've seen some of our work because we've taken the liberty of saying that we believe that it's also our responsibility to recommend to you as the policymakers ideas that might move the needle forward on connectivity for Minnesotans across the state. And we want to thank you for your leadership and work on this issue over the last number of years. That has included being able to create the Office of Broadband that has provided leadership indeed on the ideas of economic development and then last year the making of the border-to-border broadband fund, which I know you're going to talk about again this year. The members of the Broadband Task Force, they represent consumers, businesses, residential users, foundations across the state, educational users, healthcare providers, as well as wireless providers, and metro and rural local governments. And so it's been important to have that sort of broad perspective. What do we work on? We work on making sure that every Minnesotan is connected to broadband at speeds of at least 10 megabits download and 5 megabits upload. That was set statutorily as a goal in 2010, and we will revisit that goal this year in terms of our broadband work to make a recommendation going forward. There's been some developments at the federal level, and so we want to make sure that we're staying up to date about what we're recommending. We do believe that broadband access for Minnesotans individually is crucial for expanding not just personal access, but economic access and success. Achieving border-to-border broadband is an important goal, and it does come with a price tag. At the lower end, the full price tag, the latest figure that we have is $900 million. The upper end is $3.2 billion. That would be for something like a fiber. And that we do not expect the public sector to do all of that. And so I want to make that very clear. But that's something that we've included in our reports for the last couple of years, and it just gives you a benchmark for what it would take to connect all Minnesotans at that speed level. As of October 2014, and you can see this on the map before you, 78.16% of Minnesotans are connected at that speed, and you're looking at a county map here. This was measured by Connect Minnesota, which was a neutral party where providers would put their data into Connect Minnesota. Connect Minnesota, unfortunately for us, is no longer operating in the state of Minnesota, but you did, through the legislature, provide funding for continued mapping, and the deed in the Office of Broadband is working on continuing of mapping and gathering data. This is really important because to have 21st century connections and skills, we need to know where the gaps are to make sure that our communities are connected, and especially anchor institutions like schools are connected. We do have some areas of the state where schools are not as adequately connected as we would like to see, and you're going to be hearing a little more about that. Schools tend to be better connected than we see with individual homes in some cases, but that can tend to lead to some issues for students because you've probably heard of the flipped classroom. I know that you have in this committee. The flipped classroom provides challenges for students, and that is when a student is sent home with their assignment where they have to complete it then, and they need that connectivity to do it at home or away from the classroom, and they don't have the speed to watch the video or download the materials, that becomes a barrier for them. So then they need to rely on another entry point, whether it's the library or somewhere else. And that's where we see the issues of maybe the unequal ability to get broadband come into play. We also see a growing demand, and you're going to hear a little more about that in a bit, but you have also probably heard about schools that are issuing a one-to-one device policy, meaning that in, you know, the maybe beginning days of the computer revolution, there would be a computer lab, and students would go through that computer lab, and students would use 30 computers during the classroom. But now we have the iPad or the Surface, and they are each getting assigned one of these. And so you can imagine what that does to bandwidth in the classroom itself. Not only that, but then going home and what the need is when they're going out of the classroom. And I think it's important to note right now that one of the big things that we often get asked in the task force, the broadband task force, why is a wired broadband connection important still in the state of Minnesota? Why is wireless not going to just all do the trick? And this is an important question. And it has to do with the fact that wireless, and you all know this from your own use of your phone, is that there are data caps on most of our wireless plans. And so a student coming home to use a wireless plan to watch a video or to download a large reading can blow through their family's data cap rather quickly and have large charges very, very fast, often $200, $300, whereas if you have a situation with a wired connection, which is the broadband connection, through your home, and maybe you're paying anywhere from, if you have a subsidized plan of $10, all the way up to sometimes $79 to $100 connection, you are able to get as much as possible out of that connection every single month. And so that's one of the big equalizers that we look at every single time we're looking at this issue in terms of students and what is happening out there. So that ability to communicate with your teacher, to do your homework, to pay for school fees, to be able, many schools are moving to a system where you can't pay for the lunch fee or the school sports fee or the activity fee unless you are doing it online. I know that's a little bit hard to believe, but it's true. The days of writing the check are going away. And so even taking your standardized tests, you will soon hear about, that's another big crunch for the school districts, is being able to have this connection and being able to do that. So that is another important piece of this. Low-income households, there's another barrier in terms of what happens with broadband. And 20% of low-income households are below the rate of adoption. That's another thing that the Broadband Task Force focuses on. We do see some promising developments with low-income households if they are supported for a short period of time with a little bit of subsidy, 18 months. They then take it on in their household budget, and they will take it on as something that they can handle. Rural households also adopt broadband at a rate 6% below the state average as well. And so that's another area that we need to work on. So we hope to keep expanding the use of broadband and the access to broadband. But there are issues with cost. And I think you're going to hear a little more about this, but in South Central Minnesota, some folks can obtain their internet access for as low as a dollar per megabit a month. In Southwest Minnesota, it can be up to $9.72 a month. In East Central Minnesota, it can be $5 a megabit a month. And up in Northeastern Minnesota, it can be $11.67 a month. So this is, you know, there's big differential across the state as well. A big important issue for schools and libraries is the E-rate reimbursement issue and telecommunications equity aid, and I know that you'll be hearing more about that. That does help equalize things across the state, and you'll hear a little more about fiber leases. Now, I do want, with my few minutes left, to talk to you a little bit from the high-tech perspective about jobs and what this means to employers and why it's so important as well to have this sort of connection and to have students prepared for the future. Disparities in schools affect the workforce. And when we have that disparity, it will affect our ability for students to be prepared for both higher education as well as their ability to get a job. Minnesota's technology industries already, this is minus the science industries, employ 136,000, almost 137,000 people in 2014. Our leading part of that industry is computer system design, which employs 33,000. I think, Madam Chair, many of those people are in your district, from what I remember. Jobs in the STEM fields pay an average of, listen carefully, they pay an average of $77,000. The average Minnesota wage in non-STEM fields is $43,000 a year. There is a very big differential between the STEM fields and the non-STEM fields. And the prediction in terms of the shortfall coming in high-tech workers in Minnesota and science workers because of retirements and also because of our diversified economy in the next 10 years is a bit staggering. The estimate ranges between 80 and 180,000 positions. The 80,000 comes from Minnesota STEM Compass on the Wilder website. The 180,000 comes from the Jobs Wanted study out
of, I'm sorry, I'm just blanking, but I will get it to you, the site. It's out of a national group by 2020. Overall, we anticipate a 13.5% growth in the IT fields alone. And so this tells us that there are more jobs coming in this area, and right now our students are not adequately prepared for these jobs. We also see increasing impact on fields that you may not immediately think about. Fields like agriculture, all the way through to education and how important they are. We have a infographic that we've prepared for you, but we hear from employers all the time, employers like 3M, Boston Scientific, and Thomson Reuters, who tell us that they need people now, but they need people in the long term as well. And we do not need to place our hope only in one solution, but we really do need students with a broad range of skills, and we need students who have access to these skills across the state. I want to say that there's been some promising developments. Last year, the legislature did back a pilot program that has some IT certification program that is Microsoft is one of the providers of this program that's working its way through the Department of Education. This would provide certifications for students in high school who would be ready to come out of high school and ready to be able to work. We think this IT Academy model is an important model for the future of the state. We see this as a promising one. In North Carolina, where they made a commitment to a type of program like this, they had 100,000 students earning these type of certifications. Now, this isn't to say that this is the only thing they did, but it provided students with sort of a platform when they came out of high school that they had kind of something in their pocket that they could walk out of high school with as something they could earn some money with and maybe help them get through the next level of higher education. And we think that's promising. Some of them would choose to go on to get more skills in this area, and we do think that's important, and become professionals in the area. So the main part of this is, by having the connectivity platform across the state, Minnesotans overall will do better in their life. They will earn more. Families will do better. The average family who's connected to broadband, their family will earn $2,000 more a year. I think that's a pretty good investment for the state of Minnesota. And that's because they'll be able to maybe find a better job. Maybe they'll be able to file their taxes online. Maybe they'll be able to sell something online. But their children will do better because they'll be able to get a little more education. The family gets a little more education. They'll maybe start a business. And so this is a good investment. So, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for your time today, and if there are any questions.
Thank you. I do have a couple of members with questions, so why don't we turn to that now. And Representative Quam, I have you first on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you had mentioned 5 meg up, and the slide and the documentation are 6. And I understand correctly, for interacting with Connect Minnesota, that 5 was something that we had in Minnesota. 6 is sort of the one that nationally they're going by. If you can clarify that, plus looking at the maps, and I had actually the color-coded files where I could look at the where the communities and the rural areas, and it became evident with Olmsted on here is 57.69, but that's because there's a software gating of upload to about 4.45. The hardware is quite capable of much higher, and then the download speeds aren't a problem in a great part of the state. And I would think that maybe it'd be appropriate to either have discussions that they move that up, because when you're talking capabilities, unless you're streaming high def video, you rarely would bump past the three or four. So, you know, maybe if you could get into that, because the download is not the problem. You can get that satellite multiple different ways. It's the upload, and if we actually have an appropriate target selected, then we can see where we actually are missing instead of having false need highlighted.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Quam, it's such a great question. And, you know, in 2010, this is one of those moments when I was presiding as speaker, I remember, which was the debate on the floor over the speed issue. And I remember folks going back and forth about the 10 and 5 pretty distinctly. And I think that that you point out a very good issue here, which is that federally how things are measured are at the 6. And so this has been a challenge for the task force all along. It's one of the reasons we're going to revisit the speed issue to make a recommendation to all of you for next year. And as you well know, the Federal Communications Commission also just updated their recommendation to be 25 and 3, I believe. And so you're going to see something come from the task force late next year that I think will probably be more reflective of that. So I think it's an excellent catch because and there are some folks, I think it would be fair to say there are some folks on the task force and historically who want symmetry on this issue always, but I think the reality of how people use broadband is the issue of the download speed versus upload speed issue. So you caught a very good issue here, and I think it's an important issue that we're going to revisit.
Representative Quam.
Just for the members that aren't techie,
yes.
about a decade
we
ago.
We just got into something, didn't we?
I actually designed in and worked on the development of 10 gig transceivers, copper and optical, and was much more involved in this. But what it gets down to is you've got systems that are capable, and they just put in the software, you know, they hit a flag, type in some stuff, and it can change. That's where you can, your cable can go from 10 to 20, 30, 40, you know, etc., and it's software. So when we look at these maps, if the systems that's installed are capable of doing the high speed, that's a much different statement than parts of the state. They don't have the hardware or the fiber or the lines, that infrastructure present, and that's where bigger dollars go. You know, so if they just have to go to a computer terminal and type it and you're there, that I think is fairly cost effective. But if you're laying new fiber, that's where the big dollars go. And then offline, maybe I can get a update on the amount of dark fiber that we have in the state.
Thank you, and I applaud anyone who understood all of that, especially dark fiber. But that's why we're here.
Madam Chair, it's amazing the amount you can keep learning when you leave the legislature.
Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair, I really don't have a question. Looking at that map up there, I was curious, because my county happens to be yellow, but I then found a larger map that basically answered my question. Because I was curious, in my mind, we have good service, but according to this, we don't. I mean, it's okay, but it's not the greatest. And I have to thank the legislature and everyone else involved, because one of our providers was a recipient of a fair amount of grants that will address some of that need in Otter Tail County.
Madam Speaker.
Madam Chair and Representative Nornes, I think the story, especially of counties where they are below that 90%, below that 85%, is that there are pockets where there's not good service. And often it's what Representative Quam was referencing, that you have areas where they don't have that capability yet, and that's exactly why the broadband fund was created, and Representative Kreisha could tell you even more about that the return on investment is just not there without some support to get to those folks. So that's a really important thing. And then we want to get, there are a few school districts in the state where there are still some issues, and we need to, I think we will need to address and help them. And there are priorities in that broadband fund to get to those anchor institutions and help them out as well.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to add,
most
of us can't remember dial-up.
Yeah.
You know, that seems like a long time ago when we had that, but I still have constituents that do have dial-up as their only means of connecting. So.
Yes.
Thanks. Yeah. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Representative Quam was looking at me when he talked about those of us not being very techy. Anyway, good to hear your voice, Ms. Anderson-Kelleher. You mentioned about the different costs of broadband throughout the state. And is that pretty much entirely a function of, you know, lack of number of residents, or are there things like competition, things like that also that play into the mix of determining cost of service around the state?
So I'm gonna phone a friend on this one.
Hi. Please just identify yourself.
Good afternoon. I'm Mark Johnson, Executive Director of the East Central Minnesota Cable Educational Cable Cooperative, which is a school district cooperative that provides some of these kinds of services to our districts. Yeah, the numbers that Speaker Anderson-Kelleher was talking about were are the costs that we in Minnesota, we deliver this internet access in Greater Minnesota, especially to our districts in a cooperative model, right? So we do cooperative purchasing, but the costs of obtaining the bandwidth that we need, and schools consume an incredible amount of bandwidth on a regular basis. The costs of delivering that do vary from different parts of the state because we're buying it from different providers. They have different capacities into the regions. And so that's where that disparity in those costs come. And I maybe misunderstood your question. If you need clarification, please let me know.
And so, Madam Chair, I think I was mixing two things together. In my testimony, those numbers that I cited were those numbers talking about the delivery of the co-op numbers of school districts per megabit. For a consumer, it can range anywhere from some of the providers in the state, because of agreements with the Public Utilities Commission, through their agreement to serve in Minnesota, they have some cost programs that help provide low-cost service to Minnesotans. So maybe a $10 per month service to especially families who are receiving free and reduced lunch. It's a very good program. Part of the issue, and some of you may want to include this in your legislative reports, if you have that service in your area, it's often that they just don't get the word out enough to have that uptake rate on it. And then it can range all the way up to, there's a member of the Broadband Task Force who lives in Pine County, and his rate, he's in rural Pine County, he is an IT director, and his rate to get the level of broadband that he needs per month is about $300 a month. And so that gives you some idea of what a range is in terms of the rate for an individual home out there. And I think it's not uncommon for a farm site in Minnesota to be paying anywhere between $100 to $200 in terms of the bandwidth that they need to be doing what they need today.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I was presenting a bill in another committee, so I missed the beginning of the presentation. Happy birthday.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Did you bring treats for the whole class?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I thought that flipped off. You know, you didn't have to do that anymore once you weren't a member, but...
I'll pass on the reference to flip off.
Yeah, I know. I was like, I think that's a poor choice of words. I'm very sorry. That will be tweeted now, I'm certain. Yes,
there we go. Oh, now that you suggest it. I am wondering...
I'm going to turn red.
Speaker Kelleher, it's always been my opinion that a lady has the right to decide whether she chooses to acknowledge her birthday or not. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to get on task now. I'm intrigued by the handout that was in our packets regarding the Data Backpack Initiative, and I'm wondering if there's anyone present who can give me a little bit more on that, and I'm particularly interested perhaps on at first swipe, at least, the interaction with the MDE's SLED's work.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Abney, I can't believe you put me through all that, and I'm going to say it's going to be coming up in the presentation.
Right. My apologies. I'll come back when it does, with a particular interest on the dropout prevention aspect that the handout references. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Anderson Kelleher.
All right. Are there other questions at this point, or I think then we'll... Oh, Representative Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just next generation of technology, you know, what's going on now in terms of what we're looking at in the future? You know, say we get the whole state plugged in, what's the next generation of technology?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Detmer, I think that, and Representative Kreisha certainly... It's a great conversation that we were having last year, as he was very involved in, as we created the border-to-border broadband fund. And one of the important things to members bipartisanly of creation of that fund was a term that I'm not quite sure is a great term, because as you will know when I say it, I'm not sure it works, but the future-proofing of systems. But the idea that that system could be built, the fund that was created would be built up to 100 megabits, which is very high speed. So the funds that you're putting into that would be capable of that. So that really kind of points towards fiber as the way to go with those systems. I think that with wireless, now I will say, I said a piece about wireless and how the data cap piece, I do believe someday in the future data caps will come off again. But one of the pieces that's interesting about wireless, to exist wireless needs, wired technology in the ground, to have towers in the sky, you need wired infrastructure. And so we need this to exist. And the other part of that is there's a technology called fixed wireless loop that companies like AT&T are deploying in Minnesota now. So that's a kind of a next generation on top of LTE. You've heard about 5G coming to Minnesota sometime soon. So these are the next future pieces. We do see satellite in Minnesota. There's going to be a next generation satellite launched, I believe, in the next 18 months that will go up, and that will provide more satellite coverage. Satellite is an option for some folks where they can't get other good coverage, and it is obviously an important piece of the telecommunications network. So I'd say those are kind of the big pieces that we see coming.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, just all you have to do is look at the Department of Defense and our military forces, the type of technology they're using. Many times it takes years for that to filter down into the civilian world. So thank you.
Great point, Representative Detmer. Thank you. All right, if there's no other questions right now, I think we'll go ahead to the rest of the presentation, and thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Madam Chair. Well, they're coming up. I just wanted to say that I didn't think anything could be more complicated than education finance. And I realize there are other issues.
We start talking computers and my palms get sweaty, but, you know. my kids understand it, and I guess that's what's important, right? So, welcome. Please state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Mark Kroelberg. I am the president and co-founder at Prime Digital Academy, really appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today. I'm here representing both the Nerdery, which is a custom software development and design company in Bloomington that has been very fortunate to be one of the fastest growing companies in Minnesota over the last 10 years, as well as Prime. We are a 18-week accelerated learning program that's really designed around helping get non-traditional students especially up to speed for entry-level work in software development. I'm going to kind of leave the conversations about infrastructure and technology in the classroom to the other experts that are coming to speak to you guys here today. The thing that I'm going to focus my remarks on is the concept of 21st century job skills and kind of the importance of technology and education in funding towards the eventual industries that are looking to employ the people coming out of the schools in Minnesota.
Right, and I'll have you hold for just a minute. Representative Murphy, did you want to ask a question right now?
I did, Madam Chair.
Please go ahead.
Excuse me. I didn't get the Prime Digital Academy. Is that the 9-week or is that the course that you're talking about for students?
Yep, it's an 18-week program.
And is that a program that people pay to go to?
Yeah, it's a for-profit for-profit career school here in Minnesota, although we have partnerships with the city of Minneapolis as well as the state that's providing funding for about half of our students to come that are fit into low-income brackets. So we have, in our first three cohorts, about 50% of our students are paid for by the state, actually. It's a mix of state, federal, and private money, actually.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Please go ahead, Mr. Hurlbrook.
Sure. So I'm kind of here today representing both our organizations as well as the network of hiring partners that we work with at Prime. We have a coalition of about 40 different organizations, most of which are technology employers here in Minnesota that are informing us on what they need to be successful in terms of workforce moving forward. The feedback and the message that we've gotten from them in our conversations is pretty clear and pretty consistent, and that's that they need passionate people that are really excited about working in technology. And I'm here today to encourage you guys on behalf of the tech community to invest in programs throughout the educational system that foster the development of both the skills and the passion that the industry needs to see in the workforce of tomorrow. There are a few key areas that I think that you guys can have influence over as you consider bills moving forward and are looking at funding in technology and education, and that is diversity in technology. Second is job readiness, and the third is involvement of the industry and outreach in education. The first item, kind of talking about diversity and the importance of that, so much of this is accomplished through ensuring that all students have a chance to explore programming and computer science as part of their E-12 education. So some of you guys might have been aware of the announcement that President Obama made on Monday around the Tech Hire Initiative. I was fortunate enough to have been there in D.C. for the announcement and got a chance to talk with the CTO, the Secretary of Labor, and Vice President Biden about the program afterwards in a roundtable meeting. And they really did a good job of underscoring the core problem that we have, which is that there are large swaths of the population that simply don't see themselves in technology careers. This is certainly an issue with a gender gap in technology. It's also an issue with ethnicity, cultural lines, and also socioeconomic status. There are a lot of people that just don't perceive a future for themselves within technology. I think that the industry needs to take ownership for some of that lack of diversity, and we need to do better and work more towards trying to bring a broader, more reflective set of people into the industry. But I think the part that government can help with and that the educational system can work on is to try to put in place policies and systems that expose children very early on to the possibilities around computer science and technology and education. I really urge you guys to support efforts like the House Bill 672 from Representative Anderson that seeks to allow computer science courses to qualify for mathematics credits in high schools in Minnesota. That's exactly the kind of movement that we need to be able to ensure that people are getting exposed to computer science earlier in their education and that they can start to see pathways to careers for themselves there. I actually personally volunteer as a mentor at a coding club in a school in Bloomington for middle school, and it's great. It's super inspirational to go in and see all these kids getting really excited about technology. But even at that point, which is kind of 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, you can see that there's already some predisposition in their minds. You know, there are fewer girls in that program than there are boys, and I don't believe that there are fewer girls that are interested in computers than there are boys at that school. And so a lot of it comes down to just making sure that people have early access and that they can start to see themselves and see that possibility moving forward. Another item that I wanted to address is the concept of job readiness. One of the things that really pushes students forward with 21st century job skills is not just the technical stuff, not just the making sure that people have exposure to programming, have exposure to the technical parts of the industry, but that we're also preparing people with the soft skills that are becoming an increasingly critical part of employment within technology. It's important to have the technology in the classroom and to make sure that students have access to computers, that they have access to broadband, but we also need to make sure that that we are providing students with the skills to work with each other, and that we are encouraging them to develop the collaboration capabilities, the communication capabilities that are, honestly speaking, as somebody who's been in the employment sector in software development for the last dozen years, way more important than the technical skills. The fact of the matter is, if we're trying to teach our children in high school, let alone middle school or elementary school, the technical skills that are going to give them jobs when they graduate, we are really, really wasting our time. Because I don't know about you guys, but most of the technology that I use on a daily basis was really pretty much programmed, developed from a software perspective over the last 2 years. There, you're not getting technology that lasts for decades and decades. Even when technologies do stay the same, the techniques change and they move forward and evolve very rapidly. So the thing that I think it behooves us to do is to focus on the soft skills, teach the technology, but teach it as an example of this is how you learn technology, and this is something you're going to have to do if you're a software developer. You have to keep learning throughout your entire career. That's part of the gig. The last thing that I'd like to point out and talk about is industry participation in technology education. I'd really love to see support at the government level for substantive partnerships between industry and education in getting kids exposed to opportunities in technology. We have an incredibly vibrant technology community here in Minnesota, and there's no reason that we can't set an example for the nation for how industry can work hand in hand with education to share the responsibility for bringing people up to speed for work in the sector. At Prime, we're working to build a component of educational community service into our program. We've had some promising initial conversations with Bloomington Public Schools, but sadly, there isn't really a large-scale program in place to help people in the industry plug into the educational sector. So a lot of that is us kind of trying to work piecemeal with a lot of different organizations to bring professionals into the classroom, to bring that exposure down to students, which I feel is really, really important. There is a drive to want to give back in Minnesota's software community. In 2008, I created an event called the Overnight Website Challenge, which some of you might have heard of, but it's an event that's donated more than $5 million worth of in-kind services to nonprofits in Minnesota and two other states since 2008. The tech community loves things like that. They want to help. They want to be involved. I can virtually guarantee you guys that if we can find a way to create a call to action and make a pathway so that it's easy for people to participate, they will get involved and they will take personal responsibility for helping to make sure that our kids are getting the kinds of technology education that they deserve. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and advocate on behalf of our future workforce would welcome any questions that you guys have about the industry, the state of the industry, or Prime, if you're interested.
Thank you. Representative Quam, you said you had a short question?
Yes, Madam Chair. A few years ago, I noticed Utah had a big blip in the amount of tech and software business plus in the greater part of the state. I was wondering if the testifier could comment about how this could revitalize and re-energize rural Minnesota and allow and provide for some of the youth to be able to stay locally as opposed to migrate to a larger city or another state.
Thank you. Mr. Hurlburt.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a wonderful question. The great thing about the technology industry is that it is very portable, and increasingly companies are more comfortable with people working remotely. I think that Minnesota has a well-deserved and great reputation as a state with a really wonderful work ethic, and I know that there are a number of companies locally that have built a business model on people wanting to outsource. You know, the nerdery has certainly been very has benefited from the perception that people in Minnesota work really hard, and that it doesn't necessarily matter where the dev team that's working on a project is relative to the stakeholders at the nerdery. Really, a minority of the work that they do is for domestic, internal to Minnesota clients. We're a national company with clients all over the country and all over the world, and with the infrastructure and with kind of the training and the pipeline of talent, there really is an opportunity to do a lot more of that work here and to keep that revenue in the state rather than losing people to the San Franciscos, the New Yorks, and the Austins of the world.
Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And did you have another presenter?
We have a couple.
All right. Very well.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. Again, I'm Mark Johnson, Executive Director of the East Central Minnesota Educational Cable Cooperative. We call it ECMEC because it's easier to say. I represent a technology cooperative that's owned by 14 member school districts in mostly rural East Central Minnesota. And for almost 32 years, our mission has been to provide opportunities to kids through the conduit of technology. Thank you to Margaret Anderson Kelleher for talking about connectivity for our students outside the school and at home. We know that education doesn't stop at 3 o'clock or when the students leave a school building. 21st century learning is not possible without connectivity. You also just heard some of the things that our kids need to be successful in the 21st century. Skills like communication, collaboration, and critical thinking, often exhibited through technology, are cornerstone skills that our employers want in their future workforce. However, we can't forget about the need to address our state academic standards. So let's take a look at how these are being woven into opportunities for kids through technology in our schools. First, take a quick trip back in time when you were in school. Does that look familiar? Backpack full of textbooks, history texts that talked about events from a decade ago as current, heavy, bulky, and expensive science texts, math textbooks aligned to Texas and California standards. You may have been asked to read some of the textbook at home, and then when in class, you may have listened to a lecture and taken some notes. You were probably sent home with problems to complete and more reading, and your big hope was that your parents might be able to answer some of those questions and help you out. Classrooms look different today with interactive whiteboards, collaborative projects, and computers and mobile devices now commonplace. But we still have issues with expensive textbooks that can be outdated before we get them, that lack engaging content and are not consistent with Minnesota's academic standards. About 3 years ago, some state educators started to look seriously at this problem. They recognized a need for high-quality digital curriculum that was already aligned to Minnesota's academic standards and was flexible, allowing teachers to add and subtract content to meet their students' needs. They saw the potential for personal learning devices like you've heard about, laptops, tablets, and so on, to change the way teachers and students teach and learn, bringing 21st century skill development to students anytime, anywhere. We believed that the best way to address these needs was to model those skills and collaborate with educators, curriculum specialists, administrators, content specialists, and more to create digital curriculum for Minnesota schools. Anoka Hennepin, ECMEC, Intermediate District 287, and others were already creating some of these digital resources. These groups started talking about collaboration, and thus was born the Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum, which today involves over 190 Minnesota school districts working together to create digital curriculum for grades 3 through 12 in the core areas of math, science, social studies, and English language arts. The curriculum is designed to be laser-focused on Minnesota standards and work with computers, iPads, and other tablets. It facilitates personalized learning and integrates 21st century skills. It is also printable and adaptable by local teachers so that it can meet the needs of all students, whatever their requirements might be. The following quick video shows a sixth grade student describing how the partnership materials are used in place of a traditional textbook in his sixth grade math class. And we'll see if we get that.
Class, we are doing a flipped classroom, which is you do the studying at home and then the work at school. It's not what everybody calls it, schoolwork, instead of homework. And what he does is he has a YouTube channel, and he does videos on him teaching lessons, and then he sends us those videos via email. And we get them, and then we have to, our homework technically is to watch them. And then when we get to school the next day, we do the schoolwork on a website called Flexbook.
Okay.
And we have it bookmarked, so it's like an app. You just go into it and use that. And so when we get to school the next day, we go into the chapter we're learning and do the work that he has put out for us, whatever it is we were learning.
And, of course, he never got to showing you the video, but there you just saw a student watching the video, and you see a student working with the curriculum actually in the classroom on an iPad. And you'll see that students are able to collaborate in this way using the digital curriculum. And in the flipped classroom setting where they watch this video at home, come back to class, they have more access now to the teacher for questions and so on. While they're in class, they don't have to rely on their parents to know how to do that and to give them that information. And that's just one way that the partnership materials that are being created are being used. In the interest of time, I was going to show an ELA, English Language Arts 11 lesson or activity, but I'll wait on that and just describe real quick. The idea of all of these materials is that state benchmarks, learning targets, essential questions, and other standards are prominently displayed, and then the lessons use engaging multimedia content like the student was talking about, and various aspects of 21st century learning, the collaboration, the communication, and so on. So that's present through all of the materials that are being developed by the MPCC. You have a handout in your packet, I believe, that tells more about it if you're interested, or if you have questions later, I'd be happy to answer those. We do have some challenges that exist with this type of digital curriculum, and you heard about some of them earlier. Students need high-speed broadband access away from school in order to view media-rich lessons. The cost of providing computers and mobile devices is prohibitive for many districts, especially those smaller enrollment. These issues cause a disparity that requires accommodations to be made for some students, and in fact, because of these challenges, some districts just can't effectively use this curriculum that's being developed by the districts themselves. And so that's one of the challenges that we face. We talk about technology as a conduit to opportunity. In rural Minnesota, students often do not have the same opportunities to connect with people in places that expose students to the world around them. With rising transportation costs and increasing demands on classroom learning time, students are participating in fewer experiences away from the classroom, like visits to science, history and art museums, concerts, and other cultural activities. They simply can't be away from the classroom for an entire day. Each year, though, hundreds of interactive video presentations from world-class museums, professional writers, artists, and musicians are brought directly into classrooms around the state, most frequently in Greater Minnesota. For example, students in a medical careers class in East Central Minnesota, pictured on the left, were able to view a live donor kidney transplant. They interacted with the surgical team, they asked questions, and they learned what the roles of team members were. At Wright, the Minnesota History Center brings history alive through interactive video sessions with elementary and middle school students around the state. The McPhail Center for Music in Minneapolis provides a unique opportunity for music education by bringing their professional musicians to classrooms in Greater Minnesota for individual and large group learning sessions through interactive video. Take a look now at this quick snippet from a vocal lesson to a high school choral group in Thief River Falls. I think it helps everyone understand the opportunities that interactive video can provide.
money.
Why money?
Yo te Yahweh Zekana.
Yo te Yahweh Zekana.
Kwai money.
Why money?
That's the whole song. Yo te Yahweh Zekana. Kwai money. Yo te Yahweh Zekana. Kwai money.
That's what he sees.
Okay? All right, everybody together again. Yote, 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 yote. Here we go. One, two, three.
Yote, Yahweh, Zekana. Kwai mani. Yote, Yahweh, Zekana. Kwai mani. Yote, Yahweh, Zekana. Kwai mani. Yote, Yahweh, Zekana. Kwai mani.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about now.
So that kind of video and audio quality is just not possible with consumer products like Skype to get that sound synchronization and to get that high definition video. One of the challenges in providing these experiences is the cost of the equipment and, again, the bandwidth necessary for that fully interactive high definition video conferencing. Despite the challenges, I believe that all students in every corner of the state need access to this kind of interactive learning that shrinks the world around them. All students need anytime, anywhere access to learning experiences through digital curriculum and collaboration tools such as those developed by the MPCC. Technology truly is our conduit to these opportunities for all of our students. And I would, at this point, like to introduce, unless there's questions, introduce Mark Deal, Director of Information and Technology Services at Little Falls Area Schools, who will demonstrate the use of technology in schools to address specific student populations, STEM, and data applications.
And Representative Erickson, do you want to ask your question now while Mr. Deal
is coming? I just wanted to make a comment that what we just saw J.D. Steele doing, excellent use of legacy dollars in the arts.
Yes. There's a lot of good stuff in that video. Thank you for sharing that with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, and by the way, I should mention that Representative Cresha pointed out to me that you were from his hometown of Little Falls. Would you like to introduce Mr. Deal?
All I just want to say is thanks for coming up, and whatever Mr. Deal has to say is going to be incredibly insightful and brilliant because of our history. So thanks for coming.
Representative Erickson.
Well, Madam Chair, Mark Johnson is from mine.
Oh. And we had Mr. Swanson from Eden Prairie. So,
I'm chair.
And Representative Seltzer represented part of that, too. So, yes, wise presenters on part of the people that coordinated this today. So, thank you very much. Mr. Deal.
Thank you, Chair Loon, and members of the committee. And thank you, Representative Cresha, for putting the pressure on me right now. My name is Mark Deal, and I am the Director of Information and Technology Services for Little Falls Community Schools. 4 years ago, our district embarked upon a unique project called Project REAL. REAL stood for Resources to Engage All Learners. It was a project which put iPads in the hands of all of our students in grades 5 through 12 to try to teach, to bring to them the 21st century learning skills and environments that they needed. This past fall, we were fortunate enough to expand that to also include grades pre-K through 4. So now every student in our district has access to this kind of technology. Today I'd like to speak with you about four areas. Technology as an opportunity equalizer for students with special needs, robotics education as a door to new career and entrepreneurial opportunities, real-time data to improve student learning, and the utilization of technology to create more opportunities for engagement. Technology can truly provide opportunities to help all students to learn in the way they learn best. I could spend a lot of time talking with you today about all these different ways, but in the interest of time, I'd like to introduce you to some students and let you see how the learning environment has changed for them. The first student I'd like to introduce you to is a visually impaired student. The student is not blind, but rather has significant vision problems that using printed text at a normal font size from the publisher is just not possible, and it's not readable for him. So the IEP team decides that the school district should buy him a laptop and obtain electronic copies of all the books he needs so that the font size can be adjusted to meet his needs. Unfortunately, the laptop makes this young man stand out, and he does not want to use the device at all. His schoolwork suffers, he has become a distraction in class, and his attitude towards school has become more and more negative. The next school year, he and all of his classmates received an iPad for use during the school year. He no longer stands out at school. He's just like everyone else. Everyone has the same device. Everyone is caring and using an iPad. The accommodations that were being made for him on the laptop can carry over to the iPad. And his schoolwork improves, and so does his attitudes towards school as he uses the accommodations set before him. He begins to show other students how he adjusts the text size on the device and the universal accessibility features built in to the device. And soon some of his classmates take advantage of the same tools and are overcoming some of their own learning challenges. Next, I want to introduce you to an autistic student. This student does not speak with words at all, but he will have a conversation with you using his iPod or his iPad. The app ProLoquo2Go makes this voice communication possible. After lugging around a large Dynavox computer for several years in elementary school, which he disliked very much, the IEP team got together and decided to try something different. Try using a smaller device that he could put in his pocket and carry around. Ah, success, and at a fraction of the cost of the Dynavox device. Finally, I want you to meet a student who has substantial loss of hearing and needs help, the help of a sign language interpreter to get through her day. Communication with her friends had to happen through the interpreter prior to her having an app on her iPad called Sign for Me. Now she can communicate with anyone at any time in the classroom or at home, her friends out and about and at school. There are plenty of other applications as well. The English language learner student who utilizes a translator app or a site to translate English into their native language to help them understand. The general education student uses the same technology to translate a foreign language into English to help them understand. The student with speech and language difficulties utilizes the camera to record themselves properly saying a word so that they can continue to practice the word and become proficient. The general ed student uses the same app to become more efficient in their oral reading to increase their fluency rate. And the list could go on and on and on as we utilize the technology to differentiate for student needs. One of the areas that we've chosen to really take on this year at Little Falls Schools that we're very excited about is robotics. No one in the administration, the guidance office, or even the teachers expected the overwhelming interest in this class that was offered for the very first time this year. The class is one of the most popular electives that a student can take. And as you look at the slide, just over 12% of our high school students have taken robotics this year. That's a 9 through 12 building. Next year, 16% of our student body has already requested to be in the robotics class. But it just doesn't end with the class. This phenomenon is not unique to Little Falls. Since 2006, 197 First Robotics Competition, or FRC teams, have formed in Minnesota. The competition is for students in 9th through 12th grades and is a co-ed activity. And the competition showcases some of the best and brightest students in our schools. And as noted on the slide, the Minnesota State High School League became the first association in the nation to hold a state tournament in robotics. And I realize the slide says there are 186 teams, I believe. And there were that was data from the high school league last year. There were 11 more teams added this year. And this video that you see here was from the last weekend in February. The DEC in Duluth hosted the largest FRC tournament outside of the national championships. 123 teams competed in two regional competitions with a chance to advance to the national championships in St. Louis. And what you're seeing is the robots were responsible for trying to stack those totes and place them on the white platforms. You got points for stacking the most totes, and then there are green garbage cans, and if you could get that green garbage can on top of that stack of totes, you got even more points. In the Northern Lights Regional, 51 of the 60 teams were from Minnesota. In the Lake Superior Regional, it was 54 of 63 teams that were from Minnesota. The remaining teams traveled from Iowa, Michigan, North Dakota, and Wisconsin. There's going to be two more regional competitions in the state, and both will take place on the University of Minnesota campuses the first weekend in April. The competition will again feature teams from Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, as well as five teams that are going to travel from China to participate. The FIRST Robotics competition is a great example of STEM education at its very best. And there are other competitions like the Super Mileage Cars and Fluid Power Challenge that are sponsored by various organizations for students in all grade levels. These opportunities are providing students with skills that will be necessary to compete in an ever-expanding robotics workforce. But I'd like to switch our conversation for a minute and talk about the use of data systems and real-time data. Access to data is imperative for bringing about change, whether it's for an individual student, classroom, school, or district. And technology allows us the ability to generate and access that data more efficiently. Real-time data is crucial to helping educators make informed decisions about individual and classroom learning. When students have individual access to technology, this data can be generated and analyzed very quickly using tools like Google Forms, Socrative, and Kahoot. These tools allow for educators to assess student prior knowledge before beginning a given lesson or unit, determine the level of student understanding of content during a lesson or unit, and assess student learning at the end of that same lesson or unit. So let me show you an example of the use of Google Forms. On the left side, you will see questions being asked to assess the prior knowledge of sixth grade language arts students. The teacher has instant access to the data as soon as the students complete the assessment and can therefore tailor his or her instruction to meet the specific needs of the class. For example, armed with this data, this pre-assessment produced, our teacher can adjust her whole group teaching to what she knows already her students understand and where they are weak. In this circumstance, since 82% of her students have clearly identified nouns and over 71% clearly identified verbs, she's confident in spending less whole class instruction time on those concepts, thus freeing up the time to reteach pronouns, the area the data shows to be the class's weakest. Additionally, this data can be a great tool in helping to differentiate to the individual student level. This teacher can determine specifically which students need the additional support to successfully identify nouns and verbs, and which are ready to be stretched to the next level. The real-time data demonstrated here is only available when every student has access to the technology. Utilizing digital assessments to gather immediate feedback has proven to be highly motivating to students. Students like to know right away how they performed, and the days of having to wait overnight for assessment results are becoming less and less. Additionally, the manner and expediency of feedback is similar to that of the gaming culture, and this provides a hook for some of our students who may not otherwise be engaged by traditional methods. In many districts, the parents, students, teachers, administrators, coaches, and advisors are using technology to access real-time data on student progress. This valuable information allows individuals to make informed decisions about the student progress. Advisors, coaches, administrators, and teachers can track student progress to determine eligibility, grade point average, attendance, missing assignments, and determine if students are on track to graduate. Students use the system to keep track of their grades and missing assignments, and parents use the system to track student progress, missing assignments, and even what the student is eating at school. In this example, you can see that this real-time data is available on a smartphone. In Little Falls, our students are tracking all this information on their iPads using the mobile app provided by our student information system provider, Skyward. Parents have the ability to access the data from their phones, their computers, and their tablets as well. And parents utilize the data system to not only track their students' progress, but also to communicate with teachers. The incredible amount of real-time data that parents have access to has changed how parents and teachers communicate. Communication is now happening when it needs to happen and rarely waits for a scheduled date when the teachers and parents can meet. Teachers in Little Falls at the secondary level have seen a significant decrease in attendance at parent-teacher conferences. And while some of this decline may Some may see this decline as an issue, we view the change as a positive and are now looking to find new ways to use the time to improve student learning. With this type of real-time data available, there is a level of accountability that has been raised for both the educator and the student. Educators now have the greater responsibility to keep their gradebook up to date, to create meaningful assignments that truly reflect student learning, and to be working with students so they do not fall too far behind. Students now have to stay on top of missing assignments and grades, pay more attention to due dates, but they also need to perform their best all the time, as each grade is instantaneously viewable. I was approached a couple of years ago by a student who said to me, "Is there any way that you can shut off this access for my parents?" I asked him why he would make such a request. And he said, "Well, I'd like to go out with my friends this weekend, but I have a lot of missing work and my parents won't let me go." I suggested to him that maybe if he would take the time to get his work done, his problems would go away. He was not very fond of that answer. It was not what he wanted to hear at all. Beyond the real-time data, technology is the conduit being used to increase engagement between the student, the parent, and the teacher in numerous ways. Whether it be classroom websites, social media, learning management systems, email, or student information portals, the level of information available to students, parents, and the community is increasing. The increase of information allows our stakeholders to be more informed about the happenings in the classroom, school, and district. And technology is allowing for the opportunity to extend that learning day for students. With increased access to their teachers and collaboration tools, students are finding that getting answers to their questions is much, much easier. And students are using technology to explore topics of interest that they may or may not have covered in class. And many students choose to demonstrate this new knowledge through websites, presentations, videos, and blog posts. So while technology can often be viewed as impersonal, it is in fact allowing for personalized learning to take place. It is through this personalization that the relevance in learning can be found, and through the relevance, increased engagement. One thing that technology can provide for us that helps us personalize learning is data. And data is used to monitor progress, schedule students, share specific needs, and ensure programming is aligned. I would like to invite Josh Swanson back to the table to discuss data portability and how that could help provide a conduit to learning through a technology infrastructure. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Creech, you had a question.
And thank you, Mr. Deal, and thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment, members. The importance of what the testimony you just heard there and the relevance of this committee is that our districts are moving very, very fast. And we have to be very careful about what roadblocks we put in their way. And the reason I bring that up, when we look at centralized systems and we mandate those at this level, we take the tools away from them and essentially we start to put traffic cops in there. And we have to acknowledge that our job is to set some parameters but be very careful to let them do their jobs and do it well. Like I said, they're moving incredibly fast and they're the closest ones to these students. What you saw there with the Google Docs and the data and how quickly they can turn that around, once we put a centralized system in place, we pass that through incredible barriers and we send it around the world 7 times and then we send it back to that student. So I just wanted to highlight the importance of what you're doing, and I hope that as we think of the policy that we put in place, that we're really just getting out of your way and making sure that you have common ground and big pipes to go through the data infrastructure.
And Representative Arison, I have Representative Murphy first and then I'll come back to you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thinking back to last week and the testimony that we had about from the state academies and working out a plan with Minute and Purpich School, seems to me if they had consulted with Mark Johnson and Mark Deal and the McPhail people, that maybe there wouldn't have been a problem.
Well made point, Representative Murphy. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to both of you, do either of you know whether our teacher preparation programs are embedding this in the teaching of our future teachers? Because I think we would increase the teacher population if more of our candidates had exposure to this and knew here are tools I have to make education so much more relevant to our learners today. Do you know that? Because I haven't heard that coming in any testimonies in my committee, but I'd surely like to know if you've observed that in the teachers that you've hired or have come to your school districts recently.
You know, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, Mark Johnson, ECMEC. we struggle with that because the common belief is that, well, these problems might go away because all of the students coming out, you know, of our teacher programs would have all of these skills. And the reality is we're not seeing that. Now, they know how to use the technology because they've grown up using it. But teaching with it and using it are two very, very different things. And so we do struggle with that, but we do work where we can. We are working, for example, the Minnesota Learning Commons, which is a partnership of MinSCU, the U of M, and K-12. And we're working with them to try to help. They have a conference, and we try to go to that conference and bring information to them that would help with that. But I think there's a ways to go with that yet. But we are working on it. So I hope that helps, Mark. I don't know if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I would concur. But I would add that those teachers that are in their pre-service years and when they come to us to do their student teaching, they're obviously getting a dose of this.
Yes.
But that's not obviously everybody. We can't have every student teacher in the state come to us. So I would agree that they aren't receiving this yet. I think it's coming. I think the high schools are working on it. They're trying to figure out how to do it, but they have not done it yet.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and committee members, Josh Swanson, Assistant Superintendent of Eden Prairie Schools. As we started this talk about data systems, there are ways that we could use technology to ensure security, efficiency, ownership, effective practice, and the ability to leverage data in some new and innovative ways. The question around data backpacks was brought up, and I'd like to spend just a little bit of time talking about that. I also really appreciate Representative Grusha's comment about that local control and not getting in the way of school districts. Statewide, thousands of students right now change schools on an annual basis in any given year. And currently, when students move between school districts, their information does not always travel with them. In the absence of good and consistent student information, districts tend to teach or reteach what's already been learned. Students lose credits previously earned. And they may be placed in situations where they don't necessarily have the requisite knowledge and skills to be successful. Fortunately, there's a solution to this problem. The solution is a secure virtual student data backpack, which ensures that students and their information stay together no matter how many times a student may change schools. Other states and other countries are pursuing similar initiatives. Massachusetts, Washington, Utah, and Australia are all models of or for this system. Initiative has actually been started by a whole series of educational technology leaders around the state, not to remove local control or system decisions, but to look at a common framework and some parameters that we could put in place to actually ensure that we could move data back and forth. There are numerous benefits to this effort, and we've been also in conversations with Minnesota Department of Education around what this would look like and some local counties as well. So this is one of those partnership and collaborative opportunities that I think is in front of us. Right now, when a student is moved between districts, data is entered, re-entered, faxed, copied, moved around in all kinds of different ways, shipped slowly, and sometimes submitted multiple times, which means we end up with errors and other things. This project could increase both the speed and the accuracy of that, which would allow us to provide better services to students. We also have staff that are required to do all of this work, and if we could automate this in some ways through some common frameworks and parameters, there's a potential large return on investment around time in terms of that. Currently, right now, we submit between 42 and 44 reports to the state, and if we could set up systems to do that in an automated way, it would reduce that manual labor time. So there's huge efficiencies at the district, regional, and state level to putting this in place. As I talked about, improved services for students, and it also, because that data is in people's hands and learning information is in teachers' hands, it also allows administrators and teachers to make better decisions around students. I have provided a document that provides some more information, and as I stated previously, a collaborative effort has already begun, but the project needs legislative and financial support to really get off the ground and see that vision become a reality. We believe this could be a great way to leverage technology to improve transparency, effectiveness, and efficiency as we use data to directly benefit students. we'd be happy to provide some additional information or support, as we believe this could be a really valuable statewide project. I'll come back and hopefully answer some questions, but I'd like to talk for just a few minutes as we talk about technology as a conduit to sharing a little bit of experience while serving in Eden Prairie Schools, where each of our K-12 students has access to a digital tool and tremendous connectivity. At the core of our work has been our strategic plan and our local board ends policy. Our community demands that each of our students is prepared for a future that we do not yet know, that each student is career and college ready, that we maintain the highest level of expectations for each of our students and ourselves as we work to eliminate our achievement disparities in our district. Our community expects this to be carried out within a digital culture and environment. We've heard referenced earlier the need for developing skills like resiliency, 21st century skills, and to work in a fluid environment during this testimony. We do that through that digital environment, and we want to see each of our students develop those 21st century skills, be able to innovate, be creative, communicate effectively, collaborate with others, and problem solve and think creatively. We want them to be able to develop the academic rigor and content. None of that slips around state standards as we see digital curriculum through the collaborative project developed. And we also want our students to be connected to develop those global competencies in authentic ways. We leverage technology for our students to develop those skills and knowledge that are necessary to be successful as they leave Eden Prairie Schools. We expect that they have the necessary content knowledge, but that they can also demonstrate proficiency of 21st century skills and global competencies. Having appropriate technology is necessary to see this come to life in a digital age. In Eden Prairie, we're fortunate we have a community that has provided us with the resources to be able to create a conduit of opportunities for our students. We've provided our students with connectivity and access to devices K-12. We've got a robust infrastructure that supports that connectivity and access to the internet through that network to others. We've embraced digital learning and are moving toward truly personalized learning, where we can take that curriculum and personalize it to each student so that we inspire them as they learn. Our teachers are using digital data on a daily basis, like you saw demonstrated during Mark Deal's presentation, to know exactly where each of their students are so they can respond and adjust appropriately. They do that through formative assessments where they get quick pulses on what's going on, but they also benchmark and see where kids are at as they progress through the system and use that for summative as well to be able to provide instantaneous feedback for students, teachers, and parents. We've done this, but while also acknowledging that technical support and professional development must be provided and resourced appropriately. Technical support is key to this. Without that, there's a very high level of frustration that occurs, and it crosses stakeholder groups when you do something like this. We have to be able to depend on the technology. In days of old, we would always say, well, just have a plan B or have a plan C if something doesn't work. In a digital environment, that just doesn't work. You need to have the enterprise systems, redundancy, expertise on staff, and make sure that you're refreshing equipment appropriately so that that just happens automatically. Professional development is also key. The question around are our teachers prepared is an important one. We provide numerous opportunities to our administrators to talk about leading in that environment and learning in that environment. We've also spent significant time supporting and coaching our teachers, working on developing embedded job opportunities for learning for our teachers, both inside and outside of the day in synchronous and asynchronous models. We've worked with staff, but we've also worked with our parents and community to bring them along in that setting. I can't stress enough how important that proper support and professional development are to making this all work. I'd like to offer just a couple quick examples about what that looks like. And if we could jump to our elementary students here coding. These are kindergarten students who are coding. And they're learning technology skills, but if you think about it, they're learning critical thinking. They're learning how to work on teams. They're learning how to problem solve. So our students who might move into a STEM career have opportunities to develop those skills, but they're learning so many other life skills that will help them think, communicate, and work effectively. We have students transition into our middle school and do amazing things with robotics, but then we have our high school students who move into more inspired passion projects. This is a group of high school students who, in a passion project, decided to work on some app development. They actually submitted it to Verizon and won best app in state. They actually were developing something around called Invasive X to look at invasive species in lakes. And as they got going in this, they were working on developing those computer skills, but they took a real-life problem and created a real-life solution. They're now looking at how to connect in with the DNR to get appropriate data to actually launch this mobile app for boaters across the state. And so they're learning about writing and marketing and human tendencies and how to interact effectively. They're learning that it's hard work, but that it also pays off. And they're doing it in an authentic setting, in a real way. And that's appropriate to a 21st century environment. I want to move to just show a quick short video that demonstrates from our from the lens of our students and our staff what personalized learning looks like and what this environment looks like in EP.
The iPad has been able to bump up their thinking about that question that they started with. So they start out gathering knowledge, but then they end up having to synthesize and analyze, form their own opinions, make judgments about what's true and what's not true by testing out maybe four or five sites to find the answers to their own questions.
Having a device has really been able to allow for me to personalize exactly to what learning style each student needs, as well as the content. I can differentiate the content for each student without necessarily the others knowing, which is always helpful, and allowing for them to really shine in the classroom and show what they can do yet be challenged.
In the past, we might do like a poster or something like that we all draw and write on, but now it's a lot more slick, it's a lot more efficient. And right now we're doing a presentation on our certain section of biotechnology. Almost all of us are using Google Presentations, so we're all able to work on the same thing at the same time, and it makes collaboration easier.
They feel success when they are building and creating on their own, and then obviously it's also making them feel successful when they turn around and teach the rest of the class or a partner or a group about what they've learned. And so their success with in using the tool comes through in teamwork, in problem solving.
I'm going to stop right there. But as you've heard, technology is a conduit to opportunity. It's critical to the future in our future in education. It connects our students, parents, teachers, and communities. Technology strategically positions us to be competitive as a state and educational system. We currently have opportunity gaps because there's a lack of adequate funding for school districts. On behalf of our team, MASA, MSBA, I'd like to thank you, Ms. Chairwoman, and committee members for providing us with time to present today and for taking time to consider bills that would help us build that conduit that will help us truly become a system of educational excellence that will take our children and state into a great future. I'd like to pause here, and I know that we're running really tight on time, but if there are questions, we'd be happy to stand for those.
Thank you. Are there any final quick questions? And I know we were hoping to just informationally hear three bills that Representative Christensen has, and we'd run out of time for that. But if any members have a couple questions, we will continue discussion tomorrow.
On these bills?
Yes.
Okay.
Other questions? Well, if I want to thank all of you and thank MSBA for kind of pulling all of the presenters together and the High Tech Association as well. The coding, the picture of the coding and the kindergartners, I got a chance to see that firsthand when I toured one of our schools recently, and it was humbling to have a six-year-old teaching me a new trick on a computer that I could not figure out, but little Matthew showed me very quickly how to figure that out. And it was amazing how our classrooms are integrating this, and it's seamless and the great opportunities for our children. So thank you so much for helping to enlighten all of us on this. And again, we'll look forward to more discussions on this topic later. So with that, committee is adjourned.